And you are listening to Radio RMN. My name's Raylan Allen. I'm the publisher of RumorMillNews.com. We get about 40 million hits a month, so there's a lot of people from all around the world that, stop in and see what we're talking about today. My guest is William Brett Stillings for this hour. And Brett has had an unusual childhood, to say the least. His father was a Navy lieutenant, and he involved Brett in some of the experiments that were going on. Brett, I'd like to welcome you to Radio RMN.
Thank you for having me on, Ray.
And, Brett, I have to admit, I was doing some investigation about Asperger's syndrome last night because I really wanted to be a little bit more familiar with how you look at the world. And it's sort of like it's referred to as a manageable form of autism. But do you know what I found out about Asperger's syndrome last night? And maybe you already knew this.
That
the people who have it usually have incredible psychic abilities.
Well,
abilities to see through walls, move objects, things like that.
There's a correlation between those realms and being a higher analytic function or a higher elevated spiritual state, or kind of goes hand in hand.
So you knew about that then?
I don't know about the label, but throughout my life, those types of labels have been referred to me as, or have been suggested to me.
Okay, so the type of psychic ability that you have is the type that allows you to what do you call that? To relocate?
I don't know. There's I was kind of brought up that, my father was my controller. He worked at Lockheed Skunk Works and was brought in CIA through that department. And but part of the handling aspect, or the controlled aspect, was we kind of strayed away from labels. I wasn't very comfortable with labels and tend to push away against the institutionalized schooling system, if you know what I mean. There were some pros and cons to it.
Absolutely. So, I know your story, but a lot of the other our listeners don't know your story. This is kind of an introduction to my audience here. Your father was your controller, and he put you into these experiments when you were what? You started when you were about 4 years old?
Well, I more or less knew I was doing something against the norm, and there was some things that were brought up, but around that age was a slight introduction, a kind of a verbal introduction, and things kind of started going underway about age 9 or 10.
Okay, and so when your father would take you to, well, first of all, did you go to regular school? Did you attend class?
I attended public school.
You did?
There were a few times, I tend not to go into this very much, but there were times that there was private schooling. One was a very specific private school that I didn't find out until about 20 or 25 years later that a majority of engineers' kids had attended. It was kind of an informal prerequisite of studying, of finding out what the makeup of the person was, me, or the child student. But there was private schooling. There were some other deferred classes that were that required more attention or whatever.
what age group was this?
This was around sixth grade.
Sixth grade, okay. And it was held, you know, right out in public view where, I mean, it wasn't in some, you know, underground facility. It was a regular school?
Regular school next to a Ralph's.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Okay. So when you would go into the laboratory, was it, tell me what the lab was like that your father would take you to.
Well, there really wasn't any kind of lab. It was like a work environment. Like, at times growing up, I would go with my father, say, to Bendix or what have you, and, just kind of be there. You know, the engineers would be walking around. I believe what you're referring to was the lab-like environment was actually my first teleportation experience.
Okay.
Was in 1979, and that was someplace in the desert. I don't even know what state it was in, honestly, but I do very specifically, and recounted this multiple times, was that it was an 8 to 9 hour drive back. We drove a 1976 VW camper, so that the thing wasn't really geared for anything over 65 miles an hour comfortably.
Right.
So, you know, that basically at that rate would place us someplace in the New Mexico area.
So, in other words, let me see if I remember the way you describe it. You and your father were walking toward a wall. Your father told you not to open your eyes.
Yeah.
And then as you walked, kept walking and kept walking, when you finally opened your eyes, you were 8 hours away from where you had started out.
That's right. That's right.
How did your father explain that to you?
Well, the whole thing was leading up to that. It wasn't, honestly. I mean, it was and it wasn't, and when it was usually about 20 minutes before the event.
And so he would say, look, we're going to go teleport?
No. No, my father was very specifically, I know other parents, other kids that have experienced, would actually get the words that would accompany that, but mine was very much my father, would insinuate, direct. You know, a lot of it was a couple, 3 weeks prior, was basically run forward, and put, you know, I put my hands in front of me. I'd cross my arms over in front of me, and my father was very, I mean, the times that I seen him be angry was when I would accidentally, like, put my arms down at my side to run, to kind of do a very brisk, very quick walk, you know, but
sure.
more or less like a slow jog. But
now,
what
was the technology? Were they using, was it just your mind that allowed you to teleport, or was there technology there that helped you teleport?
There was technology in place, very much technology in place. The you know, let me start at the beginning so the listeners have an idea of what's going on.
Sure, that's great.
Back in 1979, my first teleportation experience was my father and I drove down to a place in Sylmar, and it was a building, and we parked in the parking lot, walked into the building, went to the second floor, and we were very specifically in the middle of the second floor of a building. And we went into a room which kind of like looked like a kind of like a school lab with a black slab, high desktops, like
yes.
A chemistry class. But they had basic computers. There was no equipment, no tools, no nothing. It was actually pretty stripped. You know, it was pretty deficient for a lab, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was talking, and there were certain sentences that I picked up. And, I heard my father say first time and kind of snickered a little bit. And I saw that he gestured towards me and then said his first time. And, the guy said, all right, you're ready to do this? And I looked up and, you know, kind of still in the dark.
Right.
And
right.
I knew something was going on that involved the training and I was processing. And we stepped off into virtually a very small side room. You know, it wasn't about 15 feet across. And there was one, you know, there was a chair and like a small kind of desk and one lamp, and that was it. You know, it wasn't much of anything at all. And there was like a elongated desk, but that was fixed, you know, like fixed to the floor, like part of the building. And my dad gestured towards me, you know, showing what you've been doing. And I started to look up, and he says, what you've been practicing? And I immediately put my arms in front of me, and I ran forward. And, you know, and he, like, looked up and says, good. And he says, he's got that? And my dad said, yeah, he does. And when the guy started talking, my father grabbed me by the shoulder and said, don't you put your arms down. Do not put your arms down under any circumstance. And don't worry, going with you. And my father said, reference to me wearing a blindfold, and you know, I think it was more along the lines that my father was being cautious, that he probably, you know, whatever. But they started to put a blindfold on, and the guy actually that my father was talking to said that he doesn't need a blindfold, you know, and my father was like, all right. And he said, keep your eyes closed. And I kept my eyes closed. I could feel a kind of a vibration and a hum around me. And, you know, that was when I started to realize that the equipment was in the room. And you know, my father said, all right, let's do this. And he said, I'm going to keep my hand on your shoulder till about the wall, and then I'm going to let go. You know, don't you stop running under any circumstance. And later, you know, this led up to my understanding and realizing that there was a basic law of when you teleport through that older style equipment, you have to, by law, or not really older style, but you have to, by law, exceed 1 meter per second or faster. You have to. If you put your arms down or throw your arms back and that sum total is less than 1 meter per second, you're not going to have your arms on the end of the teleportation. You know, there's been teleporters that have been depicted.
I see. In other words, your arms would be cut off. Is that correct?
Yeah. You wouldn't have your arms on the way out, on the exit.
Oh.
And, you know, there's depiction of teleporters that are laying horizontal that you jump into. Reason being, a certain law of having to exceed a certain distance per second is law. Time is indistinguishable from distance, therefore time moves.
That is just extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, that's the law.
Okay. Now, after you got used to doing these sort of things, you went, was it the College of the Siskiyous where you went?
Yeah, 1980, yes.
Now, how old were you there?
I was 14 years old, or coming up on 66, coming up on 14.
Now, was Ed Dames your teacher also?
Yes, for the person that taught the class was Ed Dames. There's a controversy that there's a, you know, as the universe is a multiverse, that there are certain dimensional sidelines to it, although that two, more than two people had experienced that side timeline. Ed Dames was the teacher of that class. Other than that, I'm not going to comment.
Does he admit to being the teacher?
Sorry?
Does he admit to being the teacher?
Well, he doesn't deny that a Mars class existed, and he doesn't deny teleportation. There's a far more corroborating evidence than Ed Dames would like if Ed Dames was denying that he was there.
Okay. So he's just not talking about it.
he's not talking about it, and that's his right not to.
Now, who was it in the class with you? Because some of those people are pretty famous now.
Some of those people are very famous. The class participants, when I got there, basically me and my father drove up, and I started class there a little bit late. I was about a week late into the class, and I spent about half a day actually a little bit less than 3 hours, but, you know, we got there during the middle of the day, and there was about 11 o'clock, they were starting to, the people were exiting the building, getting ready to go to join up tomorrow for a location in a different building. But this was at College of the Siskiyous near Shasta in Weed County, and, the class participants were young Barry Satoro, also known as Barack H. Obama, Regina Dugan, who I very, very clearly remember. I had, quite a bit dialogue and discussion with her in the 1980s, so did my father, and we'll get to personalities and personal life stuff later on, but Regina Dugan, she's the 19th head of DARPA, first female head of DARPA. That's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And
right.
William McCool.
Now, William or Brett, how old were these people?
Well, Barry Satoro was 19 years old, or 20 or so. He was born in 61, I believe, a little bit in September or first week of September. Regina Dugan was born, I believe, in 64, and she looked more my age. She and I were both, if you remember the kids back in the 80s, you know, kind of deprivated, you know, didn't have so much, hormones and milk kind of body to them. They were kind of, kind of natural, raw.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, and now, you have hormones, GMO, God knows what, chemtrails and
everything
else under the sun. But Regina Dugan was about my size. I was 13 and a half, and she was 16 or 17, and she was driving at the time, but her family only had one car actually at the time, and her mother was using her. Mother picked her up at the college.
Mm-hmm. Now, what were you guys studying in the class? Can you give us kind of an overview of what you were doing?
Yeah, there were no books. You took notes, but you had to hand your notes in at the end of the class. You're basically Ed Danes was who the teacher was talking about. The life on Mars and what kind of predatory life was there. Not so much as much at the time that I would have liked to know what they looked like, but he was talking about it. Basically boiled down to if it was had longer legs than you and was about 8 feet tall, you weren't going to outrun it, period.
Oh my God.
And that was it. That was you're done in. And the general consensus, like anything in common sense, you stayed close to where you came out from, whatever structure you're next to. And very first thing, when you get there, you go look outside and see what's around you. You take inventory as to what's around you and what's moving, and make sure that a rock is really a rock. Make sure that there are some things that I didn't get briefed too much on, but Andy has always talked about a lot after the fact, was that there was a type of creature that has a kind of hardened shelled back that has a discoloration to the terrain. And you could be standing 10 feet away and not realize what that is. And
these creatures are dangerous to humans. They can kill or eat humans.
It's predatory life. It's it is more actively intense than being in the rainforest. I mean, there are creatures, there are humanoid creatures, that, as Andrew Bishago has proven with his research in the Mars Anomaly Research Society, has shown that there's humanoid creatures 25 feet plus tall.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I didn't see any of that
Mars,
when I was up there.
Mars is a collection of basically a dumping ground. You know, Mars is a fractured planet, as Andrew's described, and he's absolutely correct about this. Mars was fractured in a cataclysm. The spirit layers surrounding every planet that has life, over time, you know, goes through the dinosaur age and develop, you know, insect stage and dinosaur, and develops life bands around the planet, seven layers. And, you know, people pretty much make the rest 5 to 7 of those layers.
Right.
And when that motor is broken or fractured, that generator no longer functions properly. And so Mars is basically, because greys don't like to kill off life because they're very moral, is basically Mars is a dumping ground, you know, genetic modified to produce a spiritual layer. Basically the general consensus is that the size doesn't matter of the humanoid. There's been accounts and photographic proof that there are humanoids that are a foot tall.
Wow.
Yeah. And
so you go from a foot tall to what, 16 feet tall?
Taller than that. There are species that are 30 feet tall, with equipment.
God. So in other words, it's a dangerous place.
Yeah, well, yeah, it very much can be. The general consensus on Mars is you basically either want to live in a crater, something where the predatorial life has a hard time getting into, and things grow better in the soil, you know, in a thicker environment. The atmosphere on Mars is around 890-900 millibar. It's the equivalent of being, say, about 10 to 12,000 feet.
Right. I did find breathing was difficult. You know,
it
took a toll on my lungs. I had to force myself to
breathe. You're there 40 minutes, and you start to get that kind of atmospheric headache.
Yeah.
It's
now,
very debilitating.
You know, you're the only other person that ever described the soil as red clay, and that was exactly what I saw when I was there. But I did not smell. I don't remember any smell. Tell people what it smelled like.
It took, even though my father, I found out later that my father had already basically had been to Mars or knew what Mars smelled like.
Uh-huh.
And I'm more than sure that he had gone. But he tasked me with describing what Mars smelled like. And it took about 20, 25 years of periodically he would ask, and it's weird. You would go back into forgetting. You know, like, what was it like? What was it like what? Oh, it took me 25 years of, you know, having done various work in, say, auto shop and you know, automotive and stuff. But it honestly smells like if you took car Bondo and burned it, or women's fake nails, Lee nails. That methyl methacrylic, if you burnt it a little bit and then threw in the aroma of unburned diesel fuel, just a slight aroma, that's the kind of what Andrew described as acrid smell of Mars.
Uh-huh.
And with, you know, and it also has a oceanic, kind of a rotten oceanic smell. But it's very subtle, but it's very continuous. You know, it's hard to describe. It's just very uniform.
Now, what did you do on Mars? And you were there with Barry Satoru, who we now know as President Barack Obama. Do you know why you guys were there?
At the time, it was always bothersome. When you started thinking about it, it's like, what was our function? what was our function? And my dad was all, just be there until you're noticed, until someone, you know, acknowledges you, and then get your butt back inside. And we couldn't figure out what was our purpose of going, and it was literally everything just kind of just completely just started flooding in as to why, and it was the colonization program. It was a visitation, kind of a colonized Mars, you know, for people, and there was a law because the United States was doing it, basically. From what I assess is that the Grays said, well, you have these rules, you have to be fair and employ these same rules. So basically, it was a head count game. It was get a body count on Mars, and basically you would stay there until you were seen, until you were either counted by a Gray or by a reptilian. And
so in other words, you think that you were just sent up so that they would do like a census count and count you in as one of the Earth Mars people.
Yeah, that Mars is ours. You know, somewhere historically we came from Mars. Mars was a moon to another planet, and that planet got destroyed, and so Mars became a planet to us. And
right.
That's what the asteroid belt became, was the leftovers from that other planet.
From that destroyed planet. You know, some
yeah.
people call it Maldek.
Yeah, but it was actually, and I've been told this by actually credible people, that the planet before Earth was actually called Earth.
Really?
Yeah. That's you know, did I misinterpret it? Possibly, but it seemed that both parties were, you know, at different times were very much insinuating that.
Okay. Now, we've got about a minute before we have to go to break. And what I'd like to talk about in the next half hour is what you think. I mean, why? Why did a future president of the United States participate in this Mars class? Why did he go to Mars? Do you think, I'm talking with Brett Stillings, William Brett Stillings, and he was one of the people in the Mars class. There's probably a heck of a lot more of you out there. And we're also going to talk about how Brett got his memory back. You're listening to Radio RMN on the Micro Effect Broadcast Network. And get over to TalkStream Live and give a vote for this program. We're number 4, and I think that's pretty darn good. But it'd be nice if we could beat Michael Medved today. We'll be back.
We hope you enjoyed this free excerpt from today's program. Register to become a sponsoring member so you can hear the complete interview for any of the radio shows in our library. Just click the sidebar link and select your membership level. It's that easy.